All right. Well, thank you for coming. Thank you for coming back. And a couple of housekeeping things for you, especially if this is your first time with us tonight. Don't forget that you can park in this lot here behind these windows. If you're parking there, you can just come to this door and ring the bell, and usually they'll hear you at the security desk and let you in. And if not, just knock on the door and scream or something, and we'll let you in. But also, we ask that you help us out if you can by making sure that you check your name off on the attendance sheet. We like to know who's here and who's not, or if you go MIA. And there's usually a copy of the class notes there on that first table as you come in. Also, please remember that we record our sessions. And if you'd like to go back and hear any of the older lessons, they're all up on the website. So you can just go to htchurch.com/Genesis, and you can listen to those sessions and get the class notes there. And they're also up on our podcast. So we're moving ahead at the speed of a snail here. And the last time we were together, we saw God blessing Jacob in his struggles with his uncle Laban, who was also his father-in-law. So you think you have problems at the Thanksgiving table, right? But Jacob, you remember, had fled to Laban's house and worked for him in order to get the right to marry his two daughters, Leah and Rachel. And now he has agreed to continue to work in exchange for some livestock that would be his own. So Jacob wants something for himself, and so he's going to continue to work in exchange for being able to keep some of those livestock. And we saw how Jacob had a faulty grasp of genetics, and he thought that he could produce desirable animals by using folk techniques that aren't scientific. But despite all of that, we said God caused him to prosper. So, you know, we know nowadays that just because a cow is looking at something speckled doesn't mean she's going to be able to make other speckled cows. So if we've got other chairs here, you guys can sneak in here or wherever you need to go, and I can move to the back. So we don't want you to stand for sure. But we should plan probably for next week. I do have access to another room. I have possible access to the chapel, which is not convenient in some ways because it might be tough to take notes depending on how we'd have to sit in there. But I will see if I can secure the chapel going forward, which is, if you were coming in that main entrance, you have to go past the guard and swing around to the right, and it's just there. So maybe we'll try that for next week. We don't want you to sit on each other's lap unless you're married. So, but let's see what happens. So, all right. So moving into chapter 31 now, we're going to see what happened as this deal went forward between Jacob and Laban. So verse 1 of Genesis 31, Moses says, "Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, 'Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has acquired all this wealth.' And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, 'Return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you.' So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flock, and said to them, 'I see your father's countenance, that it is not favorable toward me as before, but the God of my father has been with me. And you know that with all my might I've served your father. Yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times, but God did not allow him to hurt me. If he said thus, 'The speckled shall be your wages,' then all the flocks bore speckled. And if he said thus, 'The streaked shall be your wages,' then all the flocks bore streaked. So God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. And it happened at the time when the flocks conceived that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped upon the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray spotted. Then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, 'Jacob.' And I said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Lift your eyes now and see, all the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land, and return to the land of your family." So Jacob hears his cousins talking about him, and he sees that Laban's countenance has changed. Now, your countenance, in this context, it's your face, of course, but generally speaking, in the Hebrew Bible, it means more than that. It means your entire appearance, and it means the way that you regard someone. So we all know how this works, right? You've been around somebody who just seemed to have that dark cloud over their head whenever they were dealing with you, right? You felt a chill in the air, and you knew that they were not as kindly disposed to you as they used to be, right? You know how that works. Why don't you come into my office for a minute when you get a chance? Right? So that's what was happening here with Jacob and his cousins, and it made him afraid. And they felt that Jacob had taken their wealth, or what ultimately, in process of time, would have become their inheritance. So Jacob then receives a word from the Lord that now's the time to return home. So if you were with us last week, we said that there was already the beginning of this desire in Jacob's heart to return home and have something for himself. So he also had a desire to be more blessed by living where he was supposed to live in the land of promise. But now he's got a definite word from the Lord that the time is right. And so Jacob calls a summit meeting. So he summons his two wives to find him out in the field. Now, this was done for a couple of reasons. First, he didn't want to leave the flock. That was dangerous, right? Second, he wants to be able to have a conversation with them openly, away from prying eyes and listening ears. Let's help our friends out there. So Jacob's in a tight spot. Now, we know that he and Rachel were very much in love, but perhaps he wasn't sure how Rachel would feel about leaving, right? Now, and in the case of Leah, of course, over the course of many years, he hadn't treated her as well as he had treated Rachel. So perhaps Jacob was wondering in his mind, how much is Leah also going to support a plan to leave everything that she's known? So you have to remember in reading this, don't forget the full scope of the history. Don't forget the contention. Don't forget how these relationships have come about. Jacob has been working now for his father-in-law for a full 20 years. And yet, in all that time, neither Jacob nor his two wives have ever left in order to visit Jacob's home in all that time. So what is he asking them to do? He's asking them to leave everything that they know, and of course there's contention between the two of them, and he doesn't really know how this goes. And you know, guys, by the way, always good advice, if you're going to make a major move like moving out of the country, it may be a good idea to consult with your wife anyway. And all the men said amen, or maybe some of the men said really. But so Jacob begins to state his case for returning home, and he's defensive. He says, you know, your father's become very cool to me, but it's not my fault. I've worked hard for him since I got here, and he keeps changing the deal on me. So then Jacob says, you know, it's really actually God who protected him. And by implication, it's his God who has made prospects very bright for Rachel and Leah and for their children. And he explains to them, look, no matter what the terms of the deal were at the moment, it was always God who caused me to prosper, regardless of what your dad was putting on me as a condition. And, of course, in the interim, the Lord had also let him know that he, God, was the one who had caused the animals to mate in such a way that Jacob would become rich. And it had nothing to do with the folklore ideas that Jacob was putting his trust in. It had to do with the supernatural working of God, and it had to do with the blessing of God all along. So Jacob's pitch to his wives is something like, hey, it's God's fault that I'm rich at your father's expense. So, but it is significant, right, that God says he has observed what Laban is doing to him. And God says to him, I am the God of Bethel, And that's where Jacob had vowed a vow to the Lord. If you remember, as he's leaving the promised land and he's on his way into this unknown situation, he vows to God and he says, God, if you'll be with me, you'll be my God. I'll give you a tenth of everything that I have and so on. And so by reminding Jacob that he's the God of Bethel, he says, listen, you made that covenant with me. I promised that I would be with you, and I remembered. Isn't it good to know that God doesn't forget his promises to us, and he also doesn't forget the promises that we make to him? And so it's a beautiful, I want you to catch the feeling of this. It's a beautiful, out-of-the-blue thing that God says, hey, I'm the God of Bethel. Remember, you had that encounter with me, and you vowed that vow to me 20 years ago, and I remember what was in your heart and how you leaned on me in your weakness at the lowest point of your life. And that's a beautiful and precious word. So, and we can also see, right, all throughout the Old Testament, lots of places where God saying that he observes how his people are being mistreated by others. And that's precious. And how that causes God to be moved with compassion for them, right? You see this in the Exodus, obviously, when Moses is first having his dramatic encounter. And God says to him, and God, again, leans on the covenant as the reason why he is going to go down into Egypt and help. I've surely seen the afflictions of my people. I've surely heard their groaning. So that's the kind of God that you serve. Every time you sigh, every time a tear rolls down your cheek, you serve the God who surely sees all of that. And of course, in the New Testament, thank God, we also have a high priest who is touched with the feelings of our infirmities, because he himself has now been a man and he knows what it's like to feel what you feel. And that's awesome. God has sworn an oath to Jacob and he will defend them. All right, so notice also the prophetic streak. We don't make enough of it maybe at times, but notice the prophetic streak in Jacob's life. Jacob was prophetic, obviously, just like Isaac was very prophetic. Jacob has a word from God here, and he has at least one, and depending on how you read it, maybe two dreams. There's one dream in which he sees these animals mating and making him rich in spite of himself. And then he has this other dream where the angel is explaining to him what's happening. And if you've been with us for a while in class, then you know probably what I'm going to say next, which is that we believe that this angel is the angel of the Lord, which Bible scholars believe is a reference to Christ. It's a reference to the Lord appearing in his pre-incarnate form. Now, why do we say that? Because this is one of those times when the angel is referred to as the angel of God or the angel of the Lord. And this angel speaks not as a messenger, but he's speaking as though he himself is God. You notice what the angel says, right? Where is that? In verse... Yeah, in verse 11 and 12, the angel saying to him, I have seen what Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel. So what angel speaks like that? It's very mysterious. And of course, traditional Judaism, they have no real good explanation for that. But we know, right? So that's the angel of the Lord. But in any case, I think we can learn from Jacob. Now, Jacob, throughout much of his life, was a mess. And notice that because he was in covenant with God, God was still willing to give him supernatural revelation along the way to help him out. So we should do the same. We should ask the Lord to speak to us by his Spirit. Not saying that you're necessarily going to have that type of a dramatic encounter where the angel of God's going to show up and explain to you everything that he's been doing in your life for the past 20 years, but maybe he will. So let's not be embarrassed to go to the Lord and say, Lord, speak to me. And not just in the general sense of, Lord, lead me and guide me so that I don't make any mistakes or get off the wrong exit today. But, you know, speak to me. Give me direction. Speak to me by your Spirit. Give me the revelation that I need. Speak to me in visions and dreams. So the sum of the matter in this section is Jacob is convinced for himself, and he wants his wives to know that he now has God's command to return home. In other words, he's not just itching to get back now. Now he has a command from God to return, and he also has God's assurance, which how many of you know we need that when we're making a big move, right? He has God's assurance, I'm going to be with you. But even though he has God's assurance that the Lord's going to be with him, humanly speaking, we don't always play it right. We still give in to fear. And we still give in to some of the negative things of bitterness and so on, which his wives are going to give vent to in a moment. So look at verse 14. It says, then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, is there still any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? So you have to wonder, how long had that been building up? Are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us. That's awkward, to speaking to your husband, and has also completely consumed our money. For all of these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it. Then Jacob rose and set his sons and his wives on camels, and he carried away all his livestock and all his possessions which he had gained, his acquired livestock which he had gained in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Now Isaac is still alive. He's extremely elderly at this point. I don't remember exactly how old he is by now, but he's got to be about 170 by this point. So he has beat the actuarial odds. He's been collecting Social Security for about 108 years already. And he's saying, I should have waited till 100 to start receiving. I would have made a lot more, right? So verse 19, now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. And Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban the Syrian, in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had, and he arose and crossed the river, and he headed towards the mountains of Gilead. So that's kind of a little bit to the north of Israel there, up above the Dead Sea. So now, you know, I think everybody in this room, none of us here do we have any teenagers in the room? Okay. So we've all lived long enough to know that there's a right way to leave, and there's a wrong way. Many of you know that even if it's God who's sending you out, there is still a way to leave poorly. And we can still leave with bad feelings or leave in bitterness instead of in friendship. And I believe that's exactly what Jacob allowed to happen here. I don't know how else he could have done it. Maybe he could have gone to Laban and given him a parting gift or said, listen, I'm sorry, you're upset about this. Let's find a way to make it right. Maybe they could have had a proper send-off, but that's not what's going to happen here. So Jacob, of course, needed to have his two squabbling wives on his side. And listen, guys, you know, the fact that Rachel and Leah are in agreement here for probably the first time ever should probably have been a sign to Jacob that he was not really handling things well at this point. So, notice that the responses of Rachel and Leah are full of bitterness. They feel forgotten. They feel that they've been treated poorly. We don't really know. You know, it's intriguing. We'd like to be able sometimes to get even a little deeper behind the scenes, right? We don't know exactly what they mean by saying that Laban has consumed their money. But whatever it is, obviously they're not happy about it. And perhaps the best explanation is that they were really almost sold as slaves by their father to Jacob in exchange for his labor. But there's no mention that there was a wedding gift from Laban, and there's no mention that they benefited at all from the fact that Laban has had the use of Jacob's labor for 20 years. And so as daughters, they feel cheated, right? You married us off to this guy, and he's been hired help for 20 years, and you're treating us like, you know, just some women who he happened to be married with at the time. When that's not the case, we're your daughters, and we have no father-daughter love or warmth going on here. So, you know, apparently their father has given them no gifts, although he's had Jacob's labor for 20 years. And listen, there's lots, there's, 12 or 13 at least grandchildren here that we know of by this point, or 12 by now. So, you know, the fact that there's no warmth is telling you that Laban is a greedy guy. And so they are convinced that what God has given to Jacob is rightfully theirs anyway. It should really be theirs. And they're also convinced that they will never get anything from Laban in any case. So that's pretty sad. So because of all of this, they're willing to go off with Jacob into the sunset, literally. And this really represents a big break for these women, because this is a separation from every connection to their old gods, whatever other gods were being honored there, and their old way of life. And it's a willingness to follow and serve Jacob's God instead. And so the result of all of that is that they're going to go off, you know, skulking in the night, almost like criminals, and Jacob doesn't say a word to Laban. So they're able to flee and get away undetected, even though we've got lots of people and animals. Moses is very careful to give you the detail that they are in the sheep shearing season. And if you think that was easy to say, get up here. But Laban is in the season of shearing, and shearing was work that was, it's kind of, you know, all hands on deck, because it's just a certain time that you do it, and it's got to be done. So everybody's got to help. It requires a lot of manpower. It requires a lot of space. And so it was often done in remote places, and it needed a lot of people. So what I'm getting at, obviously, is that a lot of the men in Laban's camp, his bunch, were all far away somewhere, which made it a very, you know, propitious time for Jacob to say, if I'm going to get out unnoticed, this is what I'm going to do. It was sometime in like April or May when this was done. So he loads up the family on camels. And again, that's a sign to you, if you're in that culture and you're reading this, that is a sign that he had accumulated a lot of wealth, right? Because regular people just didn't own camels. This is like the $70,000, you know, SUV. They don't grow on trees, right? And if you have one, Dave Ramsey's probably mad at you. So, so Jacob loads up everybody on camels to have them, you know, my wives and my concubines and my kids are going to ride in style, because this is my money that God gave me, and plus my wives think so too, so, you know, going for it. So anyway, so he takes everything that he's gotten in Syria or Aram and moves back west. Now, if you remember way back with us, that term Padan Aram means the land of Aram or Syria, which is on the other side of the crossing. So there's a real symbolic picture there. You know, God's a great movie maker, right? So the symbolism is, once I cross over and I get over that river, I'm in a different environment. So everything Moses says that he got on that other side of the river, he's bringing across to where he's always supposed to be. All right. Now we have a little bit of a pun here, which I always like to throw out, because we're not really native Hebrew speakers, most of us. And so we miss some of the puns on names and things. But there's a little pun here, because Rachel is stealing the household gods of Laban while he's away. Now, you know, Rachel's name means that she's a lamb. So while he's off fleecing lambs, his lamb is misbehaving, fleecing him. All right. So I'm sure Moses got a chuckle about that one too. But so what are these household gods? Many ancient cultures, Middle Easterners, Greeks, Romans, and people all over the world today, of course, as well, have these household idols that get passed down from generation to generation. Usually they're small, about this big, something you would wrap up in a blanket and treat with special honor. The Romans would have them in the home when you walk in. It was representative of the ancestors or the particular gods that would guard your home. And they're usually just small statues of a human torso and head, so from this much up. Some of them, of course, so they would be heirlooms, and they would be passed down through the family line. And they were considered to give prosperity to the household. So this was really important. This would be like stealing your mom's silver. on the way. No, literally, right? This would be like stealing that heirloom, that wedding ring that came from grandma, something like that. This is a very big deal. So they were considered to be guardians of the home, give you prosperity. In some cases, they were used for divination. You can find other references to these kinds of idols, even in the Bible. So why did Rachel do this? You know, we don't know for sure, but there's a few good possibilities. Number one, of course, given their mood, the daughter's moods here, was spite. Mm. Right? This is just her way of zinging him on the way out the door. And that's very possible. But if Rachel really felt cheated, this could have been a way to take money from Dad on the way out the door, because it was quite possible that, being what these things were, they were made out of a good chunk of gold or silver. You know, silver many times in history, and probably back then, was considered more valuable than gold in any case. But it's also been suggested that the ownership, to have ownership of these gods, represented the headship or the leadership of the family. And so whoever owned them could be said, by right of possessing these things, to be the leader of Laban's clan, the leader of his family. And so by taking them, some people have thought that perhaps Rachel was claiming the headship of Laban's family for her son, Joseph, who had just recently been born. So, interesting. But in any case, you know, we can talk about why, but we're not condoning what she did, because this was, of course, a sin on Rachel's part. She committed a theft, right, at the very least. And it's possible that she also had the intention of practicing divination or committing idolatry through using these things as well. So following that, we have a great chase. I told you God knows how to write a great movie treatment, right? So we have a chase and a confrontation. Verse 22, Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. Interesting, because I don't know, when you read these things, and in Genesis and in many other places, the third day, it always signifies that there has been a turning which allows for some completely new circumstance to come about. Because three represents fullness. So think about, obviously, you know, we think about the resurrection of Christ, but there are so many other things in the scripture where it is said happened on the third day. And it indicates to us that the world has shifted, right? So Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. And then he took his brethren with him and pursued him for 7 days' journey. And he overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. But God had come to Laban the Syrian, which, or Aramaic. I don't like that translation because, you know, for us, Syria means a certain country in the Middle East. And that really, Syrian means Aramaic, which is kind of everything to the other side of the Euphrates. So covers a lot of what you and I would think of today as Iraq and Jordan and so on. But anyway, God had come to Laban, the Syrian or the Aramaic, in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad." So he's saying, well, what does that mean? I was just supposed to go give him a handshake and wave him goodbye, I guess. So Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountains, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mountains of Gilead. Why do you pitch your tent in the mountains? Well, it makes it slower to get away, but gives you more opportunity to hide up there in the trees, tree line. You can stay below it. So Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword?" Which is literally what he said. If you read your own version, it might be a little tamer, but it literally says, "You've taken my daughters away like prisoners of war that you got with the sword." So it's very powerful language. "Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and not tell me? For I might have sent you away with joy and songs, with timbrel and harp, and you did not allow me to kiss my sons and my daughters. Now you've done foolishly in so doing. It's in my power to do you harm, but the God of your father..." See, Laban's that guy, he just can't help himself. He wasn't supposed to say anything. But he's just, you know, I could have hurt you. "But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good or bad.' And now you've surely gone because you greatly longed for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" So this is like this is going to be an epic confrontation, right? So it takes Laban 3 days, because of what I said, the situation, to learn that Jacob has left. And it takes him a few days to catch up, but he does catch up to him because, you know, Laban's riding hard and light, and Jacob is not traveling light. Jacob is loaded down in the Escalade caravan, right? So in the meanwhile, though, Laban was given a little pause because God had spoken to him like this and told him to be cautious. Now, Laban is, as we've already seen, he's a great picture of a worldly man in whom there's a lot of mixture, right? There is some decent sentiments in him, but it's always mixed with what's in it for me. And he's confused. He's of two minds about everything. So on the one hand, he's boasting, you know, he can hurt Jacob, but what can he possibly do to Jacob without hurting his own daughters and grandchildren, right? He's angry, he's furious, but yet there's part of him that at least claims that he would have wanted to celebrate with him. At least he's convinced himself that that's the case. So he's willing to soften his tone a little bit because he says he's got some fear of God, and he also does recognize that Jacob has an understandable desire to return home. But he's very angry about this issue of the gods being stolen, which, like I said, is a prized possession. Now, this is very odd because we don't stop to consider all the time that there was not necessarily a complete monotheism among these people, right? Laban might have known that it was the God of Abraham speaking to him. He might have been completely terrified by that. He obviously believed that this was a real spiritual event that happened to him, that Abraham's God really did speak to him and that he would be terrified not to obey. But that didn't mean that there weren't other gods that he was also prepared to obey and give honor to on some level. He has not made, that branch of the family probably did not really make a complete and total break into true monotheism and a true understanding that Abraham had. And you got to remember, these were gods that his ancestors had followed for a long time. And so he's very upset that, you know, you've undercut my ability to worship my gods the way that I desire. So in verse 31, Jacob answers, and he says, says to Laban, because I was afraid, because I said, perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force. So that's kind of an insult to start the conversation going. And with whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you. And brethren there means in the extended sense that we would say relatives. For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. So he was innocent in the matter. And Laban went into Jacob's tent, into Leah's tent, and into the two maids' tents, that's the concubines, but he didn't find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols, put them in the camel's saddle, and sat on them. So there would be, you know, compartments or little storage in there where you could put some things. And Laban searched all about the tent but didn't find them. And she said to her father, let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me. And he searched but did not find the household idols. All right. Another amazing story. So Jacob explains that he's afraid. And, you know, you can say, I'm not afraid because God's given me a word, God's given me assurance that I'm with him. But, you know, we're human. And Jacob was heavily outnumbered on that day. Heavily. You'd have to go way back to when he's first meeting this bunch to realize that, or actually might have been when Eleazar came on behalf of Isaac, to remember that Laban has seven brothers. So who knows how many, you know, cousins there are. So this could have been like, you know, eight uncles and 50 cousins against Jacob and his, you know, children that he's trying to shush. So he was afraid. And it was well within Laban's power physically to wipe them all out, if that's what he was of a mind to do. And so Jacob, in his innocence, he announces a sentence of death for the thief who stole Laban's idols. Now, Laban made such a complete search, as you see, that he goes into everybody's tent including the tent of the women, which was probably a breach of propriety in itself. And Rachel covers her theft. And from the laughter, I assume that most of you could read through the lines. But in case you couldn't, she covers her theft by coyly saying that she cannot get up because she's menstruating. So you know that in many ancient cultures, any issue of blood from the body, no matter what it was, would render people and render objects or places unclean for a certain amount of time. And so Laban would have thought that that was a completely reasonable thing for her to say. And what's beyond that is he would never have suspected that his own daughter would defile his household gods in such a manner by sitting on them while she's in that condition. And so he leaves her tent very satisfied that she is not in possession of those items. So lots of trickery to go around there between Laban and his daughters. All right, so verse 36, then Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban. So this is the speech of all speeches, right? Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me?" Because, you know, he can see their dust coming for 4 days, right? "Although you've searched all my things, what part of your household things have you found? Set it here before my brethren and your brethren, that they may judge between us both. These 20 years I've been with you. Your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young. I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts I didn't bring to you. I bore the loss of it. You required it from my hand, whether it was stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was in the drought, and the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from my eyes. Thus I have been in your house 20 years. I served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you've changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." So I'm great, you're lousy, and God thinks so too. That's how that works. So that's how you boil that down. So there's 20 years of frustration, right, spilling out in one shot. And you know how that can be, right? We don't know if his wages were literally changed 10 times, but that's probably just a symbolic number that indicates an indefinite amount. But the upshot of the story and what he really wants to drive home is the same point that he was driving home to his wives, that it's God. It is a supernatural agent who has intervened to protect me from your greed, Laban. And God personally stepped in to stop you from hurting me. Interesting. Jacob refers to God as the fear of Isaac. Isn't that interesting? Meaning that my God is the one whom Isaac reveres, has a dread of. So Laban calms down a little bit. Verse 43 says, "All right, kid." Laban answered and said to Jacob, "These daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children, and this flock is my flock, and all that you see is mine." So not really willing to completely let go, right? "But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they've borne? Now therefore come, let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." So he recognizes out loud, right, that he can't harm his own flesh and blood, and he proposes a covenant, which if you've been with us, you know that to make this covenant is really an extremely serious matter between two people or two groups of people. So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. And then Jacob said to his brethren, "Gather stones." So that probably means all the cousins. We know Jacob doesn't have any literal brothers, what you and I call brothers. So these are all the male relatives, cousins, and so forth who were there. "Gather stones." And they took stones and they made a heap and they ate there on the heap. So there's a sacrificial meal that they share to symbolize that they are all sharing one life and one blood. And Laban called it Jegar Sahadutha, but Jacob called it Galeed. And Laban said, "This heap is a witness between you and me this day." Therefore, its name was called Galeed. And also Mizpah, I'll tell you what all that is in a second, because he said, "May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent from one another." If you afflict my daughters, or if you take other wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. So in those days, and you see some of this in different places in the Old Testament, this was one way to memorialize or have a record of a covenant or a treaty. It's a little more permanent than a piece of paper, right? So a stone or a pillar of some kind will be set up as a memorial of what occurred, and maybe they might carve some indications on it of what they were agreeing to. So in this case, they set up a pillar and a heap of stones. Jacob added, I think, the heap of stones idea, and I think what he was trying to signify was that every person there, all of these cousins, all had a stone, meaning they all had a share and an obligation to participate in this peace that they were making. It wasn't just something between him and Laban personally. Jacob was smart enough to say, no. I want all of your boys to, you know, sign off on what we're doing here. So you have these two names. Laban gives it that truly unpronounceable Aramaic name, and it means a heap of witness. It's a heap that gives witness to something. And Jacob calls it the exact same thing, except in Hebrew. Mitzpah, though, is the word which means watchtower. And it's a very interesting idea. So I have seen, you know, back in the day, people had Christian jewelry. You know, I'm dating myself, but back in the 80s, I used to see, you know, Christian boyfriends and girlfriends had these mitzpah necklaces. Say, may the Lord watch between us when we are apart. Now, that's a nice sentiment, but it's completely out of context. Because what this really means here is that you have two parties to a covenant, and because they couldn't always be watching each other to make sure they didn't cheat, they would invite God or a god or some gods to be the ones who would watch their actions and, you know, avenge any wrongdoing. So that's really the real... So if you still own one of those necklaces, I don't know, you may want to pawn it. I don't know. But notice that Laban is also smart enough to make sure that Jacob will feel the force of this covenant. He doesn't pick some vague name of God. He gets Jacob to swear. He invokes Yahweh as the name of the God. In other words, he says, I am picking the covenant name of the God that you serve with great specificity so that you will actually feel bound to do what we're talking about here today. That I kind of mangled that on the way out, but you understand? So that was designed to leave the right impression on Jacob and to make sure that Jacob took this seriously. So Laban says, may Yahweh watch you. So the idea is that if Jacob does something wrong to his daughters, then Yahweh is going to personally judge his actions. So then Laban said to Jacob, got to go quick, this is a long chapter. Laban said to Jacob, here is this heap and here is this pillar which I've placed between you and me. This heap is a witness and this pillar is a witness that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, that's his father in the line, and the God of their father judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac. Again, so that's Yahweh. Then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his brethren to eat bread. And they ate bread and stayed all night on the mountain. And early in the morning, Laban arose and he kissed his sons and daughters and blessed them. And then Laban departed and returned to his place. So in addition to the protections that Laban secured for his daughters, this covenant was also what we nowadays would call a non-aggression treaty, right? We're going to leave each other alone. We may not be friends. We're kind of frenemies. As long as we stay away from each other, we can come over maybe and trade, but, you know, we're not going to hurt each other. So again, you see the fuzziness in Laban's mind about worshiping God. He may be convinced that Abraham and their ancestors all have the same God. But in any case, when it came time to do something serious, which was swear, Jacob swore by the fear of Isaac, meaning Yahweh, rather than swearing by the gods of his ancestors, because Jacob says, well, I'm not really sure that we're all on the same page about who really is God. And you kind of have still, you care about multiple gods. So if I'm going to do this honorably, I'm going to swear by my God. If you want to swear by the God of your father, that's fine. And even if you think the God of Abraham and your father's God is the same, you're wrong, but I'm not going to correct you, right? You know, sometimes it's not to any profit to be a stickler and correct people about things when we know that, they're wrong. But so the point of this story and the way that this story is concluded, it's very momentous, because this is a huge shift, right? In the book, this is a huge shift, because we have been following the fortunes of the family all the way back from the time that Abraham left, right, to come over into the promised land. There has still been family connection between these two branches. There's these two branches of the family of Terah. So we haven't talked about Terah in many chapters, but Terah was the one who had Abraham and Nahor and Haran. And so these are two branches of the family that still kind of stuck together a little bit through marriage, right? Isaac got a wife from this side of the family, and Jacob also got a wife from this side of the family. This is the break. So the covenant people of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are making their final break here with their family roots. And now their story's all going to be about what is going on in the promised land. Remember I said that in the Jewish belief, Laban is often seen as even a more dangerous person than Pharaoh. Because the Pharaoh can maybe stop you from going to the promised land, but Laban can stop you from wanting to go to the promised land, which is actually much worse. So this is a final break in the story. We have cut ourselves. We've been connected to these people with these marriages for 100+ years. And this is the decisive break. It's over at this point. So very important chapter here. And as we roll forward into the next couple of chapters, we see that Jacob's on his way back to the land. He says, I just remembered I left behind my brother who wanted to kill me, who's the reason I left in the first place. So he's got to deal with that. And he's got to deal finally with the remaining issues of his own character in order to come back into the land with a good heart. So that's where we'll pick it up next time. Any questions? Thank you for tolerating being so crowded together, and we'll see if we can fix that. But any comments or questions, anybody? That's all you can take of Rachel? Yeah. Not saying that God is an angel. Not saying that at all. But the word angel, actually, in Hebrew or in Greek, the word angel is very ambiguous. In English, the word angel means a certain type of being. Doesn't mean that in Hebrew or in Greek. It just means a messenger. But the point is, this particular angel speaks as though he is God, right? And next week, you're going to see Jacob wrestling with this angel, and Jacob is even going to say that angel was God, which will be confirmed later on in the prophets. I'm not saying that he's an angel. I'm saying he's described as a messenger. But that particular messenger is the third person of the Trinity, appearing in a form as a man that can interact with people. So just like when the three angels came down to speak with Abraham about Sarah having the baby and Sodom and Gomorrah and all that, one of them was actually Yahweh. So, but it actually calls them men. It doesn't even say angel in that passage. It says men came. So it's because he's appearing in that form as a man when he's interacting with him. But no, he's not in his being, right? He's not an angel in his being, but he is appearing in an unrecognizable form, which veils what his true nature actually is. The mystery, right, for Jewish people is, how can this messenger be speaking as though he is, you know, Elohim? So that,
I think of Hebrew, chapter 1, where he said, I never called an angel my son, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, God. So,
right. Yeah, no, and we're not saying that he's an angel. You know, Jehovah's Witnesses say that Jesus was the archangel Michael, but that's not true. Michael is Michael. Right, exactly. So I hope that makes sense. So, yeah.
Are you saying that the word in Hebrew and Greek, that they mean messenger. We translate as angel into English.
Right.
And we have a different...
Right, because in
what angel is.
Right, because theologically we have a definition of angel, right, to
as
distinguish it from man. Well, no, we in the common use of the English language, an angel is, you know, in his being, we would say ontologically, in his being is a spirit who is not man and he's not God, right? But that is true, but when the Bible uses angel, you don't necessarily know what you're getting. Because that particular angel, just that one, has certain characteristics which set him apart, right, from everyone else who is referred to as an angel, and he speaks as though he's God. Now, because we don't read the Old Testament enough, we don't recognize that to be the case. Because we're not accustomed to seeing it. Like, we've all seen the Ten Commandments, right? So when the Lord speaks to Moses out of the burning bush, actually says it was the angel of the Lord saying, I am, you know, Yahweh and so forth. I am that I am. But it was the angel of the Lord. So how does an angel, like an angel of the type of Gabriel, Michael, all the rest, speak like that? He can't. A true messenger angel like Gabriel says, you know, I have been sent by God to tell you. But if you have an angel in the Old Testament that shows up and says, I have seen your afflictions. He doesn't say the Lord says I've seen your afflictions. He's speaking as though he's God. And that's a very different matter. So, and there's maybe 20 or so places where we see that person. So
I also wanted to make one also another distinction is that when it appears as the angel of the Lord and there's the form of worship, just like when the burning bush, he actually says, take off your feet because where you're standing is holy ground.
Right.
But when it's a regular angel,
right,
that angel will stop you from worshiping you.
Right, right. That happened also in the story of Samson. Because she sacrificed actually to him and he rose up in the fire. So, yes, good one. We talked about that quite some length when we were in the chapter talking about, and I don't remember, I think it's 18, when we were talking about the angels that came to meet Abraham, and Abraham was waiting for them in the tent on a very hot day. So if you're interested in that, it's a very fascinating subject, but we covered that in a lot of length at the time. I think.
Okay, about Rachel and the theft. Is there any lesson in this? I mean, as far as like honoring your father and mother, is it all goes well with you, or...
Absolutely.
For a lesson of
yeah.
You speak over someone.
Right.
For a husband.
Well, both. I was saving that, but the question, but I'll cheat because some people won't be here when I get to it. So it'll snow that night. That's what I mean by that. So, but the question for the recording, in case it doesn't come out, is there a lesson in that story of Rachel about honoring her parents and words that you speak? You know, there are a number of people who believe that Rachel brought a curse on herself by doing that, both because of the act of the theft and because of what Jacob spoke. As one who was in authority over his household, that he had the authority to curse. And they justify that by pointing to the outcome of Rachel's life. Rachel did not really get to enjoy the fullness of the promised land. She was like a Moses in a sense, where she, you know, died on the way into the land at Bethlehem, giving birth to Benjamin. And so some people have made that, Bible doesn't say that, but some people have made that connection, that she brought that upon herself, plus perhaps it being reinforced. You know, we don't know how those things work because the Lord is the one who carries out judgments, right? But it's within our power, by sinning, to set the wheels in motion. If that makes sense. So many people have drawn that connection and said, that's why... You know, you can't be dogmatic about something like that. But, you know, she was a thief in that sense. So for whatever reason she did it, it was wrong. And then, you know, Jacob foolishly you know, he overreacts. It's like, well, you know, how about like a fine or something? We have like, you know, we gotta go straight to, there's like a little Steve Martin skit, death penalty for parking tickets. You know, it's like,
whatever comes out of my house.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, thank God that's not in Genesis, so I'm not going to talk about that one. So, yeah.
Do you think, getting back to that angel topic, do you think that, because they said whoever sees God's face would die, so do you think that was his way of being approached, like being able to be approached?
Yeah, it could be. You know, God is always, there's many places in the Old Testament where people saw God, but he veiled himself. You know, he covers himself, veiled himself in darkness and in clouds. So you see that in lots of places. In the Exodus, they go up on the mountain, and Moses comes up with the Sanhedrin, all 70 of the elders of Israel, and it says that they ate with the God of Israel. They saw him and ate with him. He was sitting on he brought his portable throne with him, the pavement stone that you read about in Revelation. And so I don't remember where that is, Exodus probably around 34 or something. But you read the story when they get the law, get the commandments, and they go up, and it says that they saw God. Now, they're not seeing God, if I could, maybe it sound a little irreverent, but you'll know what I mean. They're not seeing God full blast. For God to appear to people under the old covenant, he would have to veil his glory and keep his glory from breaking out on them. Just like they transported, this will help you, right? They transported the ark, they would throw a cloth over it. You have the veil inside the tabernacle or the temple, you have a thick veil in front of it, so you can't see it and be consumed by the glory of God. That doesn't apply to us now because of what Christ did. We are allowed to worship God. Actually, this is why men don't wear hats in church. Because if you are wearing a hat in the new covenant, it's a sign that you feel that you need to veil yourself, cover yourself from his glory. But we don't need to. So that'll hit some of us at 10 o'clock. I know it'll hit me at 10 o'clock. So, so yeah.
Was Rachel lying about the blood?
Who knows? Who knows? I mean, it doesn't matter to the story, right? She's being deceptive as a thief, so.
Well, Laban doesn't think that she would go that far. Like, she wouldn't do that.
Right. Because nobody would show that much disrespect to the household idols.
Right. So is it an additional? I mean, if it's real.
Yeah, I mean, it's not really germane to the point of her being, you know, deceptive and a thief, but I mean, it worked.
It would be another disrespect,
right?
Fathers.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
The fact that you know, probably many other gold and silver things around the wealthy household. The fact that she stole the idols. You think that A makes it worse? The fact that when you lie, then you have to keep lying to cover up the lies.
Mm-hmm.
And the intensity of the lies have to keep getting bigger and worse.
Yeah, sure.
But I mean, do you think if she just took like gold coins, that would have been as bad?
Well, we don't know what her intention was. I mean, if her intention was to use that for divination, which was commonly done, or for the purpose of idolatry, then yeah, I mean, that's much worse. We just don't know why she did it. We're supposed to read that, if you'll pardon me, and go, oi, right? We're supposed to be like, we're supposed to read that and say, is it ever going to end with these people? Because they just keep injuring themselves, right? So, anybody else? Was the room cool enough?
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, guys. God bless you.